Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for tuning in today and for downloading the episode and for subscribing and leaving those 5-star reviews. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. If this is your first time, you hit it. You got it on the right one.
Yeah, you picked the right one.
We're pretty excited about what we've going on today. And after you listen to this one and love it, go back and listen to some more, download them, subscribe to us, follow us on Instagram, any of the social media platforms, and remember to give us one of those 5-star reviews on the podcast app, whichever one you use.
Yeah, and if you haven't visited the National Coast Guard Museum Association, do so now. CoastGuardMuseum.org/out and sign up to be a plank owner. You know, I got a lot of heroes, right? Like I've worked with a ton of heroes, and I respect a whole slew of guys that have taught me tons of things. And this, I think, is a hero for the entire service. This is one that we all know and one that needs no introduction.
Yeah, I think there's a whole generation of us who, like, this is the guy.
This is the guy, yeah. Like, when you're proud of the Coast Guard and they ask you, like, who are your service heroes, this is the one that we mentioned.
Yeah.
And, he's a man that needs no introduction, the 23rd Commandant of the Coast Guard, Admiral Thad Allen. Welcome to the show, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning, Admiral. And with that, I've never been more excited to ask this question, sir. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, after listening to Master Chief Bowen, I guess I've got some work to do.
You're just building his ego, sir.
I thought I'd focus on two events that shaped my entire career that happened during my first tour in the Coast Guard. I graduated from the Coast Guard Academy at the class of 1971. And was assigned to the Coast Guard cutter Androscoggin, which was a high endurance cutter home ported in Miami Beach, ultimately replaced by one of the 378 HECs. Two things happened during that tour that pretty much shaped my life in the Coast Guard. The first one occurred in the fall of 1971. The Androscoggin was sent to the yards to have a major overhaul done. It required almost taking the whole ship apart, new racks in the berthing areas and everything else. We were in the yards, the ship was wide open. They had just done spray painting down in the lower berthing areas. The engineering officer was up at the yard office on a progress report for the dry docking. And myself, two other officers, and a couple of enlisted guys were in the radio room. On the old ships, the radio room was right behind the cabin. So the captain had quick access to it. We were all sitting around after chow, just kind of talking, not doing much. We kind of heard some rumbling and some noise, and one of the radio men went over, opened the door, and basically was knocked backwards by flames and hot air. We knew then that something was wrong, and it wasn't long after that we heard the general quarters alarm. We tried to use the phone to call and see what was happening because we couldn't We couldn't leave the radio room, and we couldn't get hold of anybody. At that point, the radio room started to fill up with black, thick smoke, and we could see the flames coming up through the air castle. What had happened was they had done some work down the lower berthing areas, three decks below, and they had taped and brown papered over everything and spray painted. They had waited a couple of days and came back in and were doing some grinding to reinstall the racks. And one of the sparks from the grinding actually set off the tacky paint. And there was also brand new rubber lagging that had just been put in around the piping. So all of that was being consumed by the fire.
Perfect storm.
Excuse me?
The perfect storm right there.
Yeah. So we couldn't get out. We couldn't communicate with anybody. We could hear all of the alarms going off. And the compartment started to fill with smoke from the top down. And we knew this was going to be pretty difficult to get out of. We were trying to think of everything we could do. When the smoke was down to about our waist and we were bent over because we had trouble breathing at that point, I took my my knife and I cut a hole in the insulation on the side of the bulkhead for about 12 by 12 inches. And we took one of the emergency destruction hammers that was in the radio room. And we started beating SOS on the bulkhead. Turns out there was a quartermaster on the dock with everybody else that was assembled there. He heard it. The engineering officer had come back down to supervise the response, and there was a repair party down trying to fight the fire. The quartermaster told the EO, a lieutenant named Oscar Poppy, who still lives in Texas, and we stay in touch, by the way. He put on an OBA, and at that point, the flames weren't a problem, but we were disoriented and couldn't see where we were going. We were being asphyxiated by the smoke, and at that point, we were laying stomach down, holding on to each other. Some people were starting to lose it and cry, and we pretty much thought that was in the line for all of us when I saw this face with an OBA on stick its head through the smoke. Ultimately, we all joined hands, and Oscar Poppy let us out and basically saved our lives.
Wow.
So at the end of that, there was a board of inquiry on the fire, and it boiled down to whether or not they were going to court-martial him or give him a medal. So they gave him a medal, and they gave him the Coast Guard Achievement Medal.
Perfect.
Which in my mind was a little low, but I think he was willing to accept that given the alternative.
Yeah, very, very true.
I think all good stories go that way. You're either going to get court-martialed or get a medal.
Yeah. I mean, so you know, it's a good story.
One interesting sideline to that, when I graduated from the academy, we were all wearing khakis at the time, or basically the Navy uniform with Coast Guard insignia. My father, who was a retired damage control chief, just asked me casually one day if I wanted any of his uniform items that fit because he didn't need them anymore. Of course, being a cheap ensign and wanted to spend his money on other things, I said, sure. So he gave me a pair of khaki shoes, and I happened to have them on that day. And, of course, that evening we went out and had probably too many drinks, celebrating the fact that we were alive. And I remember calling my dad and telling him that I made it out because I was wearing his shoes.
Perfect.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a deal.
So that's sea story number one, I guess.
Hey, I'd ask you, Admiral, just a couple questions on that one. So was that a choice assignment out of the academy back in 71?
It's funny you should ask that question. The Andras Goggin had been on a cadet cruise the year before, and nobody liked the XO. And back in those days, you picked your assignment by class order. And my best buddy and I wanted to be on the same ship together, and we were like 10 places apart and being able to pick. So we decided if we picked the ship that none of the cadets liked, there was a better chance the second one would have a chance of getting the ship too, and it worked.
Perfect. That'll do it. That's good.
So nothing's changed.
Yeah, right. Did you ever sail on her, sir?
What, the Andras Goggin?
Yep.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And we came out of the yards. We were extended because of fire damage, but I was part of the last crew. They actually decommissioned it at the end of my tour, and it was ultimately replaced by the Coast Guard cutter Dauntless. Down in Miami Beach.
And as the decom crew, did you get like a priority 3 transfer out of there?
I left early because I had torn the ligaments in my knee playing football, flag football, and I couldn't go to a WPB, a patrol boat, so I got orders to the ops center in San Juan, so I left a couple of months before they actually decommissioned it.
That worked out for you, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
The other event occurred in the second year I was on the Andras Goggin. My brother-in-law, Captain Tom Yearout, he retired a few years ago as chief of staff out the 14th, married to my sister Wanda, Alan Yearout. He came on board the ship from the class of 72, 1 year behind us. So in December of 1972, it was a Saturday night. Everyone was kind of laying around having a few beers and, you know, kind of telling tall tales and all that. And we got a call from Tom Murat, who was the OD on the Andrew Squadron. And he said that there was some kind of an event that occurred, a mass casualty, and they were looking for volunteers to go Air Station Miami up in Opa-locka. So being young and bulletproof, we get in the car and we drive 80 miles an hour up Lejeune Road to Opa-locka. We get there and they got two H-52s turning, the predecessors of the H-65s. Myself and MST from the ship, Henry Brooks, and a bosun mate from the ship, Ed Babcock, were put on an H-2 and we're flying where we don't know. It ends up we're out in the middle of the Everglades and they put one wheel on a levee, enough for us to jump out of the door, and then the helicopter went away. At that point, we looked down and we were looking at the remains of Eastern Airlines Flight 401, which was an L-1011 that had flown through the altimeter alarm because the pilots were looking on some kind of an alarm light and they lost situational awareness and basically flew into the Everglades on their approach to Miami.
Wow.
Spent the next 24 hours with everybody that was there going through the wreckage, looking for survivors, and then dealing with the pretty tough task of what to do with the people that didn't survive. Of course, there was all the issues about the investigation that would have to go on and that sort of thing. There were 176 passengers on the ship. Only 75 survived.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
By the time, I think it was like 2 or 3 o'clock the next day, there was finally a low enough priority of people coming and going where they could get us out of there. But it was a pretty harrowing experience. The fire occurred when I was 22, and this happened when I was 23. So those two events pretty much imprinted the rest of my time in the Coast Guard.
I can imagine, sir. Yeah. What so with the 75 survivors, how did you know, what did you guys do to manage them?
Well, the plane went in about, I'd say, maybe 75, 80 yards from a levee in the Everglades. So you could get close and you had to go down, and we were all wading around in chest deep water.
With the gators.
Well, not with the diesel, with the aviation fuel, there wasn't anything around.
Okay, well, so that's a plus. Yeah, that was going to be our first next question.
The JP5 protected you from the animals,
yeah,
at least.
Well, that's a good thing. It's right? Needed out there.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the impact of the environmental exposure was to the fuel, but I guess I lived through it. So.
Right.
Anyway, that actually patterned something that happened 2 years later. I was an ops center controller in San Juan, and we had an L-1011, same type of aircraft, that had left San Juan bound for Miami. And they declared an in-flight emergency with an engine on fire, and we're going to return back to San Juan. I was the controller on watch, and given what I'd experienced 2 years before, all I could think of was another mass casualty. So hopefully I wasn't crying wolf. I mobilized all the forces I could. I recalled all the public health doctors down there. We launched a Navy jet from Roosevelt Roads to fly intercept. We positioned the Sagebrush, the 180, about 10 miles offshore in the path to the airport. Launched all the small boats in kind of a picket line in case the plane didn't make it in. And set up a couple of triage stations with the local medical people. Ultimately, they landed without incident. But my sit-rep the next day, I had a road on the whole thing. It was probably about 3 pages long. But, you know, the experience helped me be in a better position had something would have happened.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's sure. That's something that I think most people would have never even thought of, right?
Right. Like
or not even taken action to do. Wow.
It all becomes additive over your career. And right. I guess there's one final, story I would tell. One of the things about being an officer in the service is the higher up you get, there's less chance you're going to have your hand on the tiller or be on the con. But there's a greater chance that you're exercising command and control authority and you have responsibility and accountability for what does happen. Several years later, when I was a lieutenant, I was a group commander in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Before sectors and before the large groups that we had, there were some small groups along the Atlantic coast that were actually lieutenant level billets. From 79 to 1982, I was the group commander in Atlantic City. I had 4 stations. Barnegat, Beach Haven, Atlantic City, and Ocean City are Station Grade A.
That's a deal, sir. As a lieutenant, you said?
Yeah, it was. Wow. Yeah, that was a great job.
Yeah, I bet. That's a lot of responsibility for an LT.
And we had a 95 footer and an ant team. And back then, and we solved this with sectors. you could have three or four different commands in the same area. So I was responsible for law enforcement, search and rescue, ACE and navigation, that sort of thing. But there was a captain of the port over in Base Gloucester in New Jersey that took care of all of the environmental response. And then there was an officer in charge of marine inspection in Philadelphia. So depending on what you want to do with the Coast Guard, you dealt with a different command. And that was one of our rationales for creating sectors ultimately in the Coast Guard. But while I was there, probably the biggest case of my career occurred. And it was on the 5th of January, 1980. This is back when they were having a fuel crisis in the country. And they were moving a lot of product up and down the coast as fast as they could. So they were in close to shore. It was winter. And late on the 4th of January, the night before, there was a McAllister tug towing a barge called the Michelle F. It had almost 3 million gallons of heating oil on it. They became disabled around Barnegat Inlet. They were about, I think, probably 9 to 10 miles offshore. We went out and tried to assist them. There wasn't a lot we could do. They drifted south throughout the night, and at first light they were getting near the southern end of Long Beach Island, which was close to Station Beach Haven, and just north of Brigantine Island, which is north of Atlantic City. I had sent the 95 footer out to Cape Star, and they had gotten the 180 underway from Cape May. About 2 in the morning, a blinding snowstorm started, so we had a visibility problem. And it was
of course a blinding snow. I mean, why not, right? Like, just keep adding to it. Yeah, that's good.
And it was probably about 20 degrees. as they drifted past the inlet of Beach Haven, the incoming tide was sucking the barge towards the inlet, and the crew of the Michelle F had to cut the tow line, otherwise they would have been dragged in. So then the barge was being set towards shore, and on the deckhouse of the barge were two crewmen on the barge. Ultimately, the barge grounded in the Brigantine Wildlife Refuge. It's got another name for it now, with the two crewmen on the deckhouse. So there was water washing over the barge, which was partially grounded, and the men were in the deckhouse, and at any particular time, there was 2 to 3 feet of water around them. We launched an H-52 from Cape May. There was an air station at Cape May at the time. It wasn't in Atlantic City. They ultimately had to sit down in a parking lot of a McDonald's because of the weather and problems they were having. So there wasn't going to be any aviation support. At that point, we launched a 44-footer out of Beach Haven with a crew of 4. And when they got on station, they were trying to go along through the surf line and actually locate the vessel. When they finally did, we had to make a decision on what we're going to try and do. I had come in the middle of the night, probably around 2 or 3 in the morning. I was in the command center in Atlantic City. This is one of those things where you're not on scene, but you're making the operational call on whether this is a go or a no go. And this is back before we had green, amber, red, and some of the crew resource management stuff we do now. We were just, you know, using our intuition and experience trying to figure out what to do. We were talking with the boat coxswain, BM2 Matthew Greer, and we were asking what the art of the possible was, and I said, can you get in and get those people off? He says, if I can make it to the surf line, I can do it. Let me think about it. And then the next thing I heard was, I'm going in. And then there was like silence for 30 minutes, at which point I aged probably 20 or 30 years.
Right.
Didn't know what in the hell was going on. Ultimately, Matthew maneuvered the 44-footer through the surf line. He got close to the barge, and he radioed him over. He said, if I get alongside, can you make it from the barge house to the rail? And, of course, they told him, if you were there, we're coming out. So he made a pass towards the barge, and I think he had to make a couple attempts, and he might even touch bottom a couple of times. He finally just put the throttles all the way over. The three crewmen that were with him had gone up to the bow rails of the 44 and had tied themselves to the bow rails in a line. And the crewman came out and jumped over in about 2 to 3 feet of water, rushing over the barge. And then they were handed down to the three crewmen into the Turtleback, the survivor cabin in the 44. On the way out, the 44 almost pitch-pulled backwards on a wave they hit. And after probably about 2 or 3 breaks, they made it into the open and called in and said that they were safe. They they couldn't re-enter Beach Haven Inlet, so they ran south to Absecon Inlet, Atlantic City. And I was able to meet them when they came to the dock at the station there. I relieved them of all duties and gave them a bottle of Wild Turkey.
Nice. That's great. I'd ask you, Admiral, why?
I had the extreme pleasure of writing up the citation for the Coast Guard Medal of Extraordinary Heroism, which they all received.
Awesome. That's awesome. Solid. Yeah. Why didn't you, so with the kind of our current command and control thing, I don't know if we'd ever let 30 minutes go without talking to the crew. Why did young Lieutenant Allen allow 30 minutes to pass?
Well, first of all, there was nothing I could do about it. We had made the decision they were going in. At that point, you can imagine the coxswain was pretty busy. And back then, communications were not that good either. You know, we had VHF FM, but it wasn't anything what it is today with Rescue 21. And, you know, sometimes, whether it's a pilot or a coxswain, you got to let them do their work. At that point, they're the ones that are making the call. It was his call to go into the surf line, and it was his call to approach the barge. So at that point, you bank on the expertise and the valor and the courage of your people. It certainly was hard on me waiting for the outcome. But as I said earlier, the more senior you get, the more time you spend worrying about things like that because you're not actually on scene. But you're the one that's authorizing it. You have the responsibility to oversee the fact that it's done correctly.
Best answer I've ever heard, Admiral. I've got nothing. Yeah, that was – thank you. Thank you for that. A little boot stomp there for some people that that haven't learned that lesson yet.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, thank you, sir. What we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Katrina too. Your role in that, sir. Could you just talk a little bit about it?
Sure. It's actually rather a long story, but
we got time if you do.
I was chief of staff of the Coast Guard at the time, and there's very few situations where you take the sitting chief of staff. That's a position no longer exists. It's been replaced by the Deputy Commandant for Operations and Deputy Commandant for Mission Support.
So you were in charge of both at the time? Is that Chief of Staff would have been both of those, right? DCO and DCMS?
Yeah, basically the Chief of Staff was the Chief Operating Officer for Headquarters, managed everything, reported to the Commandant through the Vice Commandant.
Yeah, that's a heck of a job, I would think.
You're like the Ops Officer for the whole Coast Guard.
Right, yeah.
So I had gotten to know a lot of folks in the administration, in the National Security Council, Homeland Security Council, just for by virtue of the fact of our operations and things like that. When Hurricane Katrina came ashore on the 29th of August, the story's pretty well laid out there. You know, the Coast Guard was extraordinary. Over 30,000 people were rescued in 1 week, and especially the folks under Commander Bruce Jones at Air Station New Orleans just distinguished themselves in every way possible in how they responded. The problem there was, this is Alan's version, I'm not sure we really understood the problem right away. Everybody thought we were dealing with a hurricane. The hurricane was gone in about 24 hours. What happened was when the city flooded, we experienced, in my view, the effect of a weapon of mass effect, but there was no terrorist attack. But it had the same effect on the city, and they basically lost continuity of government. They lost all the means of civil authority, the ability to command and control their police and their fire and so forth. So for a week, pursuant to the emergency declarations, there were all kinds of resources and forces flowing into the area, but there was no capability locally to put them under a single command and control structure and apply them to the highest needs, and therefore everything was random. You were rescuing who you could find, and pretty much everybody was down there was self-deployed and reporting back to their own administrative chains. And FEMA's not supposed to conduct operations. That's not their job. Their job is to provide resources. And pursuant to the 10th Amendment, I'm not trying to give a constitutional lesson here.
Well, sometimes we need them, sir.
Yeah, that's true, too.
All powers not granted to the federal government reserved to the states, and disaster response is one of those. So the federal government's only supposed to assist. Late Thursday of that week, I got a call from Admiral Tim Sullivan, who was an advisor to Secretary Chertoff, and they said they were thinking about deploying somebody down there directly to New Orleans to assist Mike Brown. I previously served as Atlantic Area Commander on 9/11 and some other large-scale operations that we talked about here. And I had a long talk with my wife, and I said, I'm not sure if I go down there I can fix anything, because it looks like the stuff may be on recovery. And she pretty much told me that I'd been telling everybody throughout my career that my definition of leadership was the ability to reconcile opportunity and competency. So given that feedback, I said I'd do it.
That's a good woman, sir. Yeah, she had your back on that one for sure.
But I don't know what happened in the interim, but I didn't get the call until Monday morning, Labor Day, the 5th of September, to go down. And I immediately got an airplane, flew into Dulles Airport, and it was Labor Day, so I had to go tell it. By the way, this was pretty much a surprise to the Commandant and everybody else. It was like a straight shot from the Secretary and the President. Anyway, I scrambled, got my stuff together and headed on down. I got to Baton Rouge the night of the 5th of September, and I flew into New Orleans on the 6th of September. And that's when I came up with this notion that they lost continuity of government. What we ultimately did was we created a joint, I would say an ad hoc task force with Lieutenant General Russ Honore, who had a joint task force, Katrina, the local responders, and National Guard. We put together a planning cell on the dock in New Orleans, next to the Iwo Jima that had been moored there, so we had command and control and helicopter capability. And what we basically did was we divided the city into sectors and assigned each one of the sectors to one of Rest Honore's military components. So, for example, the 82nd Airborne got the Central Business District and assigned the Marines to the Lower Ninth Ward in St. Bernard Parish. And then we started methodical house-to-house sweeps to see if there was anybody alive, and then start dealing with the tough issue of remains recovery. But we did it in support of local police officers and firemen. So what we tried to do was maintain the legal authority for the response at the local municipal level, but then provide security access, rubber boats, anything we could do to communications to make it work. And we ultimately touched every dwelling. You probably remember there were circles with X's and icons, right, indicating what the result had been. We did that, and as they dewatered the city, we did two more sweeps. So there were three sweeps of the city done to make sure there wasn't anybody to be rescued or start the process of remains recovery. Throughout the whole time, we didn't try and preempt the mayor. Every night, we would present a plan for the next day. And if there's something the city didn't like, we would change it. But it was a matter of trying to get this thing organized and not encroaching on the local authority of the mayor or the governor. And even at that level of coordination, I was questioned by some folks in Congress and others whether or not I exceeded my authority and was actually directing operations. But at that point, my response was, what's your point? So.
What gave you the impression that they had lost continuity of government? I'm just curious, is just nobody to answer questions, or nobody had answers to questions? Is that kind of how it played out?
They had lost their emergency operations center. They had no command and control capability for fire and police. The mayor had gone to the top floor of a hotel down near the French Quarter, and they basically had no infrastructure. Many of the police had come from home. Some of the police had to make a decision on whether to stay home and save their families or go in.
Right.
They had lost track of where everybody was at, and they didn't have any way to contact them. The very first request I got from the Director of Homeland Security for New Orleans once I got down there was, I need some place to put my firemen and my police so I can actually manage them. And that day, within a couple hours, we made the decision to bring a cruise ship from Galveston moor behind the Iwo Jima, and that basically became the lodging area for the emergency services for the city of New Orleans. Once we got all that established, then it started working. But for a week, nobody could figure out why it wasn't working. It wasn't working because they had no command and control capability, and the city couldn't actually function as they normally would.
And how long were you down there, Admiral?
Well, I was assigned. I got down there on Labor Day 2005, and I wasn't relieved as principal federal official until February.
Yep. Sorry, Bill had a question. No, I cut him off.
It's okay, Phil. That's what we do, right? We're buzz mates. We just yell at each other.
Right.
No, I think, Admiral, it was, having been in the Coast Guard during Katrina, but I was only a third at the time, and just remembering all that, I don't know if I've ever heard a better description than the loss of continuity of government for what the real problem was. In all those years, that seems to kind of cut through all the other stuff and really get to the heart of the problem.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
More than anything, I think I've ever heard about it before.
Well, one of the issues is I talk a lot about complexity as a risk aggravator. And what I mean by that is when things become very complex, and they can become complex because of scale, you know, geographical area, the number of people that are involved, like Superstorm Sandy. But the effects of complexity are operating doctrine, SOPs, TTPs start breaking down, and the normal practices don't work anymore. And in some cases, we'll even find people failing to honor contracts. There were issues with contractors failing to honor waste removal contracts during the Ebola crisis. And when things start getting that complex, you got to kind of rethink the problem. And sometimes the standard operating procedures, while they're handy to train and standardize everybody, sometimes you have to kind of redefine the problem and rethink it and then attack it the best way you can.
Embrace the chaos. That's what it sounded like to me. You embrace the chaos. I like it.
Well, you know, I had the extraordinary opportunity to speak at Bernie Weber's memorial service in Cape Cod while I was commandant. And I noted in my remarks in the eulogy that he created the art of the possible where none existed. Right. And sometimes you just got to sit down and keep thinking about this thing, put people around you that can give you good ideas. I have a lot of diverse thoughts, you know, have people have the ability to speak truth to power. And you just got to put a lot of brain power on it. You don't do it by yourself.
That's I could tell a quick Katrina story that involved you, Admiral. There was on the dock, there was an MK that was bent over the outboards of a 25 RBS, and he was swearing up a storm. And you came down the dock, and he turned around, saw you, and you said, "We're on this together. Keep up the good work." And then shook his hand and walked off. But I think that reinvigorated a lot of people. Just had to get that out there. I definitely remember that one.
Yeah, you got to be careful about what rent space in your head.
Right.
Right.
Well, let's talk about 9/11 too, Admiral. Did you, so you were Atlantic Area Commander at the time?
I was. I was over in Portsmouth, back then they called it a support center, now it would be a base. I was actually getting my annual physical. They were actually drawing blood, and across from the hall was a break room, and the TV was on. And I heard the report that the first plane hit the tower, and of course everybody's trying to figure out what was going on. And after the physical, I was going to go down and do an awards ceremony on one of the 270s at Portsmouth. Second plane hit the tower, went back to work, obviously. Closed New York Harbor, closed Boston Harbor because one of the planes had taken off out of Logan, and we closed Potomac River north of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge.
Was that your call, Admiral? I'm just curious, like, was the Atlantic Area Commander, you were authorized to make that call, like, we're just going to close the harbor?
Well, actually, you close the harbor under the local Captain of Port Authority.
Gotcha.
In this case,
yep.
The Captain of Port of New York operating with the First District Commander, but we were all on the phone together talking.
Right.
And, trying to figure out what the next shoe that might drop would be on the maritime side and what should we do. And the other problem was I'm sure they still haven't got the number right. And I've heard anywhere from 300,000 to 1 million people on lower Manhattan. They had to put together an armada and evacuate them. The First District Commander and the Captain of Port were all handling that. What I did was, as the Atlantic Commander, I diverted all the cutters are underway in the Atlantic to certain areas to try and mitigate risk. Did something I never thought I'd see in my life. We had a 270 anchored off the Statue of Liberty with their guns uncovered, which is kind of a chilling picture. We had another one outside the Verrazano Bridge. And then I picked what I thought were the most risky ports in terms of what would happen if we lost them. And I moved cutters off those ports and then put them under the OPCON of the captain of the port, which had the authority to manage the anchorages of the ship traffic and all that. We basically created a command and control platform for the captain of ports to use in managing what was happening in the ports. So we did that in off of Delaware Bay, off of Chesapeake Bay, off of Houston. And I think that was it. Those are the ports that I thought were most vulnerable. And we stayed there until we felt the situation was stabilized. A couple of days later, I got in a plane and flew up to Newark. They had grounded everything, including the Commandant's plane. But I was authorized to take the plane and fly up to Newark and then go to Ground Zero because the Atlantic area troops were there. So I was at, I actually flew into Newark, went over to Staten Island and took a small boat to the cove right next to Ground Zero. I was able to walk over and talk to our folks. We were resupplying Ground Zero with a buoy tender that had been moved from Bayonne over, and they were using their crane to send water and other supplies in. It was hard to get to Ground Zero because you couldn't drive a car down with all the debris. You just blow the tires. So we became a key resupply point for the efforts that were going on.
What was that like, Admiral, when you first went down there and you saw the guys that had been working there? Just the feeling and the view, I guess.
Well, I had done two tours on Governor's Island. I was completely familiar with the area. And I drove up and down the West Side Highway all the time. And I was so disoriented when I walked there. I was looking around, and finally I could figure out where I was at because there was a hotel right next to the World Trade Centers. And there was a walkway that went over the West Side Highway and then led over towards the Hudson River. And I was very familiar with that. And I looked up and I saw half of it.
Wow.
And that's when I knew where I was.
Wow. Yeah. That's powerful.
Yeah. I don't have anything.
Yeah. I mean, that's
I don't have anything useful to add. That's why I'm kind of quiet over here.
Right. No, I just, what a time to be alive, I guess, to be there and to be able to exert your leadership on it. Amazing.
What I think, we see coming out every podcast we do, we kind of see something coming, right? And we've got Admiral Allen here, and we've kind of talked a little bit about kind of everything that happened for a time period in the 90s. It feels like, the early 2000s. It feels like he was in charge of, Katrina, 9/11, the Deepwater Horizon after retiring, a whole bunch of stuff. But the stories that he chose to tell were from when he was an ensign. All the way back in the day. And that's what we find, like, the stuff that happens so early in your career is really what kind of creates your outlook forever. Because we hear it all the time. People who retired, as W-4s, retired as Master Chiefs. But the story they tell us is back when they were a seaman or a seaman apprentice.
Well, I'm sure whoever was doing your OER, Admiral, was like, of young Ensign Allen, hey, man, this guy just cut out a 12-by-12-foot piece of insulation and knocked SOS. He's pretty resourceful. Yeah. We should probably get him into higher authority.
They were more worried about me screwing up the ship's exchange, I think.
That's good. Well, Admiral, just a couple of final thoughts, I guess. I'd be curious to know two things. One, how was it being the Commandant of the Coast Guard? And then two, what's the most important leadership lesson to you that you could impart to the rest of us?
Well,
twofold
question.
Well,
I never thought I'd be a flag officer, let alone the commandant. So I'm kind of, I used to call myself an accidental admiral, but Jim Stavridis stole that for his biography, so I can't use that anymore.
Are you going to write one? Is there one in the works?
I keep threatening to.
Yeah.
I had a guy that I really liked, a vice admiral in the Navy named Al Konecny. He was the deputy fleet commander in Norfolk when I was the land area commander. At his retirement ceremony, he talked about the fact that the reason you would want to be a flag officer or lead a service is not because of the side buoys and not because of the honors, authority, and the rank that you hold. You do it because you can have impact and you can be relevant. And Pete Pace, who I admire greatly, former chairman of the Joint Staff, said it probably better than anything. The American public only loans you those 4 stars for 4 years. They belong to the American public, and your service ought to be towards them, not self-aggrandizement or being caught up in the fact that you're in a high position. So I guess that would be my thought on the Commandant side.
Good. Public service is a privilege. That's what I always view it as, right? We got a finite amount of time to do as much and have as much impact as we can. You certainly had one.
I was pegging my fun meter.
And what about the leadership lesson, Admiral? What you know, I know you give a ton of talks, leadership symposiums at the academy and elsewhere. You know, what's kind of the most important one that you relate to people?
There's a lot of ways to talk about leadership, and you know, every leadership model is of some value. But models are just a way to think about life and frame decisions. They're not perfect. As I tell everybody, if models were perfect, crime would have stopped when they issued the Ten Commandments. It obviously didn't. In my view, it boils down to two things, and it can seem kind of strange. One of them is lifelong learning, being insatiably curious, always trying to understand what's going on and learning more, because the world's changing so rapidly, you can become stagnant very quick. And I always tell everybody the status quo is an oxymoron. So this notion about constantly refreshing yourself intellectually is really important. And the second one is probably the most important. It's emotional intelligence. It's being able to empathize, understand what's going on, what most motivates your people, showing compassion when you need to, and strong leadership when you need to. But understand the human factors that are involved in what you're dealing with, and you're actually dealing with human beings. You can get into a lot of complex discussions about leadership, but in my view, it's lifelong learning and emotional intelligence.
Love it, sir.
Yeah.
Perfect. One last question. It is the 100th anniversary of the Chief Petty Officer this year. You got any chief stories? I know your dad was one. I mean, I'd be curious. You know, let's ask that first. When your dad, once you got accepted to the academy and he's sending you off one day.
Was he, like, disappointed that you were going to be an officer?
Was he disappointed, or, you know, what advice did he give you?
Well, let me preface it with another quick story. My dad was born in Comanche, Texas, and one of 10 kids in a family. They were dirt poor. They migrated west in the Dust Bowl days and settled in a small community in southeastern Arizona. And they were so poor that they were running a herd of goats on the side of a mountain and raising honeybees, and they were going to school with no shoes on and all that kind of stuff. My dad left home when he was 14 and joined a civilian conservation corps camped in Yuma, Arizona. He had gone into a post office and saw a Coast Guard recruiting poster. So after Pearl Harbor happened, he basically hopped a freight to L.A., lied about his age, went to Coast Guard when he was 16. Served a while up in Oregon and beach patrol, and then shipped out to the Pacific, Coast Guard manned army transport. He also worked in the Atlantic at the end of the war, bringing troops back from India. When he got out, he went back to Oregon because he liked it so much and became a logger. Dad was a pretty big guy, and he was staying at a boarding house, and they gave him chips to eat at a local restaurant. He went in there one night, and a drunk was bothering the waitress. He threw the drunk out, and a week later, he married my mother.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's great.
they went to northern Arizona. My older brother was born in Tillamook, Oregon. That's where it happened, by the way, Tillamook. I got great roots in Tillamook, Garibaldi. To northern Arizona, and he was logging there. My mom was pregnant with me, and the logging industry fell in. So he got out as a third-class coxswain. Back then, you didn't make bosun until you made second. And he took a bus to Seaman to come back in the Coast Guard. And I was born while he was underway on the Coast Guard cutter in Minnetonka, out of Terminal Island. And later, my sister Wanda was born in Long Beach. And that started a long career. Ultimately, he retired in 1965 when I was a sophomore in high school in the Bay Area. He was at that time supervising explosive loading out of Concord for weapons ships that were going to Vietnam. When he retired, we moved back to Arizona where he was from, and nobody can figure out why I'm from Arizona in the Coast Guard. But the reason I went to the Coast Guard Academy was my senior year at Palo Verde High School, our star quarterback got hurt and lost their first three games, and the football coach started playing for the next year and basically benched all the seniors. Which completely infuriated me. I had applied to the Coast Guard Academy, had an appointment to the Naval Academy and some other schools. I finally decided to go to the Coast Guard Academy because I heard they had a Division III football team. I thought if I could make the football team, I could tell my coach to stuff it.
That's pretty good.
That's how I got to the Coast Guard Academy. When I got there, they didn't know who I was. So I walked on the football team, and ultimately I was the captain my senior year. I went back and told my coach to stuff it. 2 years later, he won the state championship, and he told me to stuff it.
What was your record at the academy, sir?
The first year, I think it was 0-9.
Fair enough.
Ultimately, we started a rebuilding program. We were 5-5 my senior year, and the next year they went 8-2.
That's solid.
Victory playoffs. So, yeah. Anyway, so that's the reason I went to the academy. And then I had to stay 5 years, and then things started happening.
What did your dad say when he was he still alive when you went to the academy?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. He was alive when I became the commandant.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, at the ceremony when I relieved Tom Collins, that's when President Bush came and awarded the presidential unit citation to the entire service for Katrina.
Right.
And he's making remarks up the podium. He looks down at my dad, and he was talking about his dad. He looks at my dad, and he goes, yeah, it's not bad to follow in your dad's footsteps.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
So that was worth everything to my dad.
I'm sure. Yeah.
What did you ever have any you got any – I'm sure there was some interaction with a chief between Junior Officer Allen and some chief petty officer somewhere. You got a story about that?
Well – I talk a lot about relationships between officers and chiefs. I get questions all the time about it, not only because of my own experience, but because of my dad. But you've got to create this relationship that recognizes the experience of the chiefs, and also recognizes the fact that the chief is actually dealing with an ensign or a JG there that has, just like with me, could become the commandant.
Right.
Neither one of you wants to miss the opportunity to learn and teach. And so you learn from the chief, and the chief teaches the officer, and together you grow. And frankly, the hallmark of the Western military that sets us apart from the rest of the world, the reason there's never going to be any, in my view, any serious challenge to military forces in the United States or the UK and places like that, or the non-commissioned officers. You know, in the old days, you got rank based on you were in the royal family or something like that, but the non-commissioned officers are the heart of it. Part of our services.
Hear, hear, sir. Love it. Well, Admiral, I know that now you are you're on the Capitol Campaign Committee for the National Coast Guard Museum. Could you just, you know, kind of tell us your, I guess, maybe impression, like your goals for the museum, whatever you want to say about the museum.
Well, I don't deal with them on a day-to-day basis. I can tell you this, that Susan.
We do, sir. You don't want to. I'm just kidding. Great. Just kidding, Drew. Just kidding.
Susan Curtin is an extraordinary individual, the person that's leading the chair right now. Her dad was J.D. Power, and he served in the Coast Guard on an icebreaker. She actually did a hitch as an enlisted reservist.
Yep, we had her on the show before she talked about
it. She is terrific. I just think she's extraordinary, and if there's anybody that's going to bring this project home, it's going to be Susan, and she has my full support.
Perfect, Admiral. Yeah, and if you're not a plank owner yet, we encourage you to visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out and sign up. You get the plank owner certificate, and you help bring this museum to reality.
Yeah, go. Let's get it built.
I'm already there. And also support the Coast Guard Foundation. I think you've had Susan Ludwig on as well.
Yep. Yes, we have.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, I got my comment about the foundation is they rescue the rescuers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Phenomenal the work that those guys do. Yeah, and if you're not contributing to the foundation, please consider it, because it's pretty impactful and pretty substantial. Well, Admiral, any parting shots or any? I mean, you can throw a couple at Bill. I think he fell asleep. I'm just kidding.
No. Sometimes there's just nothing to add.
Yeah, that's true. Any parting shots, sir?
All around expended, no alibis.
All right. All right. Well, Admiral, we so much appreciate your time, sir. If there's anything we can do for you going forward, please reach out. And, you know, I know you're going to be in town next week. If you want to get together for dinner or a couple drinks, you let us know.
Well, I'll see how my schedule goes. I pass on my best to John Winter over at the Marine Safety School. He was a DCC, worked for me at Long Island Sound.
Yep. Okay, will do, sir.
Will do, Admiral.
Hey, thanks again, Admiral.
It was an honor talking to you, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org, that's CoastGuardFoundation.org, to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.